We know as analysts, there's a long, fairly long literature on mourning and its connection to creativity from the time of Freud's work to George Pollack's work and others. But that's too intellectual. Let me make it more personal. And then I'll talk about Freud and Maimonides. My father and my mother lost a combination of 10 siblings and a granddaughter, murdered by the Nazis, plus their parents, you know, by the way, and aunts and uncles, by the way. For me, I've heard stories about their siblings, and I think, look what they would have done, what they would have created, not just what families, but ideas. And I've realized, actually, in my analysis, that I've for years have been trying to make up by writing books what would have been done by the aunts and uncles that I never knew or cousins I never knew because they were murdered. So creativity can have a reparative, never enough perhaps, but a reparative quality.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Nathan Scheinberg. Dr. Scheinberg is the author of two books this year. The first is called Psychic Mimesis from Bible and Homer to the Present. And the second is called The Secret Symmetry of Maimonides and Freud. And while our conversation touches on these subjects, it's really about he, the man, and in particular, the man and his attachment to his religion. Now, this is a topic, as you will hear us discuss, is not widely talked about in our field, though religion plays a role in all of our lives and all of our patients' lives. It is sort of spoken of, if at all, sotto voce, all under the table in secret. Especially if one's religious affiliations involve a meaningful connection to a deity. That's certainly never spoken of. And that's too bad because it is part of many people's lives. And if our field is serious about speaking about things that others don't speak about, I think we should open the topic up. And this is the first of other conversations I have in the works with clinicians who have meaningful attachments to their different religious affiliations. I thought it would be altogether reasonable that we start with Freud's Judaism and go from there. Dr. Scheinberg is a retired Freud professor at the Hebrew University and a former Wallerstein Research Fellow in psychoanalysis. He was born in Germany. He attended the University of Chicago College and Medical School. And his third novel is called A Windmill, A Night, and a Jerusalem. And I hope you find meaning in this new conversation, as I certainly did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Nathan Scheinberg. Nathan, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you. Let's jump right into our topic today. Freud was very public about two aspects of his religious affiliation. The first was that he was an atheist. And the second is that he was a committed cultural Jew. In fact, he famously characterized himself as, quote, a fanatical Jew. And it seems that over the past 100 years or so, our colleagues, with important and notable exceptions, have by and large used Freud's self-representation to characterize themselves. That is, that our field and many individuals in the field have felt that they could only declare themselves religious insofar as Freud declared himself to be affiliated with his religion. But the truth of the matter is that that's not accurate, that we know that many of our colleagues, currently and over the decades, have important relations with their religion, including relations with their religion's deity, with their gods, but that they have kept it private. Now, on the one hand, that's perfectly reasonable because it is essentially a private matter. But my hunch is that it's more than private, that it's secret, that there's a bit of a taboo associated with having a religious affiliation that's meaningful. And, you know, it used to be taboo for analysts to talk about their sexuality. And now the taboo has moved to talking about one's religious affiliations. And I'm hoping that conversations like the one you and I are about to have, and that I am planning to have with others of other religious affiliation, will soften up this topic, soften up the taboo, and help it evolve and mature into something more honest. Which brings me to you. You and I have a bit of a history. I had interviewed you on another podcast about your quite fascinating work with your developmental research, where you followed individuals from birth until the age of 30, interviewing them, testing them, videotaping them and their families, and coming up with significant observations and conclusions about family constructs that play an important role in the production, if you will, of healthy 30-year-olds. And the link to that will be on the show notes. Beyond that, I reviewed your book on Jacob and Joseph for the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic a few years ago. And this past year, you sent me, for consideration for this podcast, two books that you wrote this year. Let me repeat that. Two books that you wrote this year. One is called Psychic Mimesis from Bible and Homer to Now, Inner Lives Over Time. And the other is The Secret Symmetry of Maimonides and Freud. And I read these works, and they're rich and scholarly and very thoughtful. And as I read them, I was always thinking, so how are we going to turn this into a conversation that would be of interest to our listeners? And I read it, and I thought about it, and it finally just emerged, you know, that feeling when an idea emerges. What emerged for me was the listener to this podcast and or the reader of these books would be interested in something about them. And what I think is most interesting about it is you. You are deeply and publicly very involved with your Jewishness. And much of your work is around that, and I think there's value in our getting to know that part of you, how it lives in you, and perhaps how it plays a part in your clinical work. So you and I had some email exchanges in preparation for this, and in one of them, I asked you about your relationship with God, and you wrote me back an email, and you gave me permission to read it as part of this conversation, which I will do in a moment. But to outline how we'll proceed, we'll begin with my asking you, A, about the email, but also in general about your relationship with your religion, how it's a piece of your past, your family, your history, and how it lives now in your current family. And then we'll talk about, you quote Harold Bloom who described wisdom literature. And then we'll talk about your book on Maimonides and the similarity you see between Maimonides and Freud, especially as it focuses on their interest in revelation and hidden. Things are hidden and then they're revealed. And that's important to both of them. And that's written about widely in your book. And then we'll talk about clinical cases. There are, you have some disguised cases to present where you feel that the patient's religion and your religion played an important part in your work. And I think that's especially important because almost never does one find a patient's religious attachments brought up in case material, though everybody has some connection with religion, whether you're of any one of a number of religious affiliations or whether you're whatever it is, religion is in all of our lives in some way. And yet it's not mentioned in write-ups. And the evolution of one's religious attachments over the course of a depth treatment is also something that I certainly have noted and many people have noted. So I think getting to clinical material will be important. But to return to your email to me, in response to my question about God, you wrote me, quote, "More personally, since my father was in Auschwitz, I care about, quote, God, unquote, as much as he did about the 1.5 million children murdered there. We have, at best, a sense of personal disregard," close quote. And when I read that, I smiled, and I shared this with you, because it seemed to me that on the one hand, you proclaim an alienation from a God, and yet at the same time, it seemed to me that you maintain an intense relationship with this God. And with that as an introduction, Nathan, why don't you tell us a bit about that email and pick up the ball about you and your Jewishness?
Well, let me start this way, and you'll help me along, but I'll say there's an oddity about Judaism that's different than, I think, other religions. One can be fiercely Jewish, like Einstein or Freud or other less famous people, Derrida, and not believe in God. One can't be fiercely Catholic and not believe in Christ. One can't be fiercely Muslim and not believe in Muhammad. I think that's true. One might be able to be Buddhist and not believe in God. Maybe that's true. I don't know enough about that. But Roy Grinker, who was my chairman when I was a resident, said there's been a 3-millennia tension between the nationhood of Judaism and the religious aspect of Judaism. And it's built in. You have King David, and then you have the Kohanim, you know.
The priests.
And there's a tension between the two. I have a significant belief in Jewish culture and how it's been sustained for 3.5 millennia by Jews and how they've endured. You know, Spengler was frustrated because he believed nations rose, civilizations peaked and then deteriorated. But from his perspective, the Jews were stubborn and wouldn't go away. It didn't make sense. It doesn't matter to me to explain that. But one of the aspects of Judaism that I value is how I've been going at my oldest son, who's 9, request. We've been going to shul, an Orthodox shul, every Saturday. And I go and my 3 boys sit with me and we listen to the Parsha HaShavua, the part of the Torah that's read that day. And right now we're reading through near the end of Moses' life where he recites, these are the laws you have to live by, and you have to live by them. Now, some of the laws are giving sacrifice and this and that, but a lot of the laws are things like, when you glean your fields, leave the edges for people who are poor. When an orphan or widow comes to the gates of your city, not to your house only, you have to feed them and take care of them. They're very clear stipulations of how you treat others. And then right on the bima, engraved in glass, sandblasted in glass, are the words of Rabbi Akiva. It says, you know, when a Roman soldier said to him, you have to tell me the summary of the Bible while you're standing on one leg. And if you do, I won't kill you. in front of all the other Jews. So he stood on one leg, Rabbi Akiva, and he said, love your neighbor as yourself. That's the summary. He said, all the rest is commentary. The summary of the Torah is love your neighbor as yourself, and all the rest is commentary. That's what I value, and not only value in Judaism, but that the Jewish people have sustained an identity that may be shifted despite dispersion. My wife is from China, and I say to her, if the Jews have been able to stay in the Middle East like the Chinese stood in China, what a different history it might be, you see, for Judaism. So that's what I find rich, is that the way Jewish people have focused on in their life, on how to behave, and have been able to sustain their identity despite exile and dispersion.
Go ahead. Finish what you're saying. The idea of God, go ahead.
It's kind of irrelevant to me personally. I understand it's very important to people who are religious. It's irrelevant. And what's amazing to me is that people maintain their Jewish identity even if they don't believe in God, like Freud. Yes.
So you see, your vision sounds very similar to Freud's vision, yeah? And you're very public about it.
Well, in the past, I had not been. Partly what freed me up, as I mentioned to you, is my supervisor, one of my supervisors, Bob Wallerstein, and he said, analysts tend to shy away from listening to, not talking about, listening to their patients' religious beliefs. And yet, a belief is an inner part of one's life. If we don't listen to it, if we aren't receptive to it, we're missing part of their inner life, and then we're missing material, clinical material.
And so since then, you not only listen to your patients differently, but you also reveal yourself differently, yeah?
Right.
You have an important family history that connects you to your religion, and you said you're okay sharing it.
Right. Both my parents came from Poland, and as a child, it was intriguing to me, they both disliked Poland because as children, they were beaten up for being Jews, as children, or their sister. My father tells me a story that his one sister, he had four brothers, one sister came home once with torn skirt and bleeding. And one of his brothers, who was a soccer fan, said, who did this to you? And she said, you know, Shmulik and Michik, whatever their names were, you know, these two guys. And he went out of the house and he brought back both boys and by the collar, dragged them back and stood beneath the balcony of their house and called up to his sister and said, are these the two? He wanted to be sure he got the right guys. And she was crying and said, yes. And he knocked their heads together until they were bleeding. That is the Poland that my parents grew up in. I grew up in the U.S., and I love this country, and I didn't experience anything like that. Some anti-Semitism, but never anything that systemically within the culture. So, well before the Shoah, the Holocaust, my parents didn't like the country they were growing up in. That's very strange to me to have to. They loved their families, they loved their community, their Jewish community, but they didn't like that. My father was one of the few Jews accepted into the Warsaw Polytechnical Institute because they had a limit on Jews that were accepted. And he didn't go because the Nazis interrupted his education, but he was accepted despite his being a Jew. Now, my father was in various labor camps and in Majdanek and others, and then ended up in Auschwitz. He was part of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, and then after the uprising, they were brought to Auschwitz. So that was late in the war in 1944. My mother was sent by her mother with a younger sister to go to Russia, and the Polish government in exile insisted that Russia take in Polish Jews. They didn't want to do that. So she lived and worked in labor camps in Russia during the war. But that's the background. And I emigrated here as an infant.
How old were you?
I was 6 months old, and it was a very long 3-day boat trip where we all were seasick.
And what year was that?
49.
I see. So was your family of origin a religious family?
Yes. Now, not a simple yes. My father's was very religious. His father, who was a very bourgeois man, nevertheless went to Orthodox shul, and he had such a nice voice that on Kol Nidre, on Yom Kippur, the shul asked him to sing Kol Nidre. And the non-Jews would gather around, this is in wintertime, at the outside of the shul to listen to my grandfather sing Kol Nidre. So he was Orthodox in that sense. My mother's father was extremely Orthodox, and she rebelled and became a communist. She said Stalin cured her of her communism, but before she went to Russia, she was a communist. And she started working at 9 in the factories to help pay for food in the house because her father refused to work on Sabbath. So she had a negative attitude towards Orthodoxy.
And how do you come to your style of religion?
I'm aware that when my father would take me to synagogue on Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, and Pesach, not on Sabbath. And I asked my father when I was a kid, why don't you take me the other days? And he pointed out to me, you see how on Yom Kippur, when I come into the synagogue, the rabbi comes up and shakes my hand? I said, I see that. My father said, if I came on Sabbath, he wouldn't do that. That's his way of joking. Or I asked him, my father sent me to Orthodox school 3 days a week in the afternoon and weekends. And they didn't teach us well. They did terrible teaching, unfortunately. But when I was 15, I went to a conservative synagogue school, which was excellent, academically excellent. I just called my former teacher of Yiddish literature, is a pediatric cardiologist and now in his late 80s. And I just called him to tell him about this book and send him a copy. But I mean, Yiddish literature in a Hebrew high school, that's what it was like. So I asked my father when I was 15, why did you send me to this Orthodox place? You knew the education was bad. And my father responded, I wanted you to know what you were going to reject, was his answer why he sent me to an Orthodox place. So that tells you a bit about, you know, my background. And I do have, when I go to synagogue with my kids, I love the tunes that remind me of my father's singing. And standing with him. I do enjoy the music. And I really make an effort. When I lived in Israel, in Jerusalem, for 4 years, I went to synagogue every Saturday because I wanted to hear that Torah portion read by people in Hebrew. And I had people around me who knew Hebrew extremely well because it was their mother tongue, that I could ask them any question about any word and they would know it right away. It was very enjoyable.
And what's the connection, if any, between everything you just described and your thinking, living, breathing as an analyst?
I'm thinking of something I wrote in the Maimonides book that Maimonides said. He said, look, the Torah was written for mankind, humankind. So it's going to be written in language that humans today understand. So, for instance, a human of the time of the Torah and, you know, 2,000 years later until Maimonides understands that God pointed with his finger, held out his hand, showed his back to Moses. But Maimonides said those are analogies. God doesn't have a finger or a hand or a back. It's just a way that humans at that time would understand God. He even said, and this is controversial, all the sacrifices at the temple, you know, on this Saturday you sacrifice a lamb plus a dove plus an ephah of flour burnt in a certain way. The fragrances go up to God, and the Kohanim eat the food. The priests eat the food. You got to feed them, you know. And Maimonides indicated that, look, because Jews were so close to non-Jews who did lots of sacrifices, at that time when the Torah was given, it was important for them to be able to sacrifice animals. He hints maybe there's a time when we won't do that anymore or have to do that. He hints that there might be further development of humankind to not need sacrifices. So my connection is when I read Maimonides, I focus on what does it tell us about inner life, the tensions in inner life, how to overcome certain impulses that are destructive or beyond satiation, how to live a tempered life, the kind of life that Aristotle would describe, a life in the middle. You know, the Talmud says, how do you know when you're done eating? Just before you're satisfied, you push yourself away from the table. Just before. That means one needs to pay attention to one's body, one's stomach, and judge when that is. Or one of my teachers said to me years ago, who was a cigarette smoker, he said, I know that I'm having a problem with the Sabbath when at the end of the meal I want to have a cigarette. I won't do it on Sabbath, but if I have the sense that I feel like having a cigarette, it means that I'm not fulfilling the meaning of Sabbath enough. So I was impressed that he would pay attention to his own body to judge how much he was enjoying or not enjoying the Sabbath. That's what I find as valuable in Judaism, is our attentiveness not only to inner life, but how one should behave. There is even the word for living properly is follow a certain derech or pathway, walking a certain path in life. And there's another ambiguity in Hebrew that I love very much. It was just found, it's in the Shema, first paragraph. The word davar in Hebrew can mean word or it can mean thing. It's ambiguous. You need to look at the context. But it means that one's word can almost be as substantial as a thing. So God says to the Jews, Ela dvarim shani natati. These are the words, things that I'm giving to you. A little bit ambiguous. But I would value the idea that our word is as strong as a thing.
Is that the link to your being as an analyst, the valuing and appreciation of the fullness of words?
I'm going to now answer to you by saying Ted Shapiro's recent book on psychoanalysis and language, which is a collection of his papers, he says psychoanalysis is translation. An interpretation is translation. What does it translate? A feeling, an impulse, a bodily experience, and then we try to turn it into words. And there's a thought process and a feeling process that goes on inside ourselves, that if we do that transformation properly with feeling, we get healthier.
And you see that in both worldviews?
Yes, I do.
Fair enough. Let's move on to your book on Maimonides. And I'm going to read a few sentences to introduce it. And you write, Maimonides and Freud had similar motivations for their researches. By studying the hidden in our most precious texts, we not only learn about hidden meanings, but also ennoble our lives. Both were, to some degree, concerned that superficial misunderstandings of their ideas could lead to societal censure, and of course both were correct. This is not an intellectual or philosophical exercise for Maimonides or Freud. It is one of our most precious tasks to live a fuller, better life. Tell us about that. What is it about exploring the hidden and then revealing the hidden that you and they feels it enables a fuller, better life?
Look, the connection that I found, I'll mention a couple things. That one reason I like Maimonides so much is he says things like that got him into lots of trouble. He said, neither rabbis nor yeshivas, that is Orthodox schools, should charge money for their work. Neither one should. Rabbis should not charge for their work. In fact, Maimonides never charged for any of his rabbinical work. He worked as a physician, worked terribly long hours. So now he got into so much trouble with some rabbis that in the Geniza in Cairo, the ancient scroll that they discovered in Cairo, the Jewish scrolls, there were written death threats to Maimonides because he said these things.
I didn't know that. Huh.
Extraordinary. Written, you know.
Right. The hidden and revealed. That's the theme that was so precious for him and Freud. Yeah.
That's right. He said the Torah is written at multiple levels. And I'm asking you to listen to this now as an analyst with your analytics. Mm-hmm. There's a superficial level that seems obvious, and is obvious. Certain things like thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's wife or his ox. Thou shalt honor your mother and your father. The Ten Commandments are yes and no's. There, I think, you know, six yeses and four no's, very clear. But then there are commandments that you shouldn't mix wool and linen and wear them. That's not the same as thou shalt not kill. It tells you don't do this, but where's that from? Thou shalt not kill makes a lot of sense if we just say don't kill other people. Because why? Life is precious, and who are you to take someone's life? But don't mix wool and linen, that's called a hook. It's a certain type of law where there's no explanation in Torah, none. Or don't mix meat and milk. Why not? You know, a good cheeseburger sounds pretty good to me, you know. But it just says don't do it. So Maimonides says these laws have hidden layers of meaning to them that we can explore. But the rabbi wrote before Maimonides, you should never explain the chukim, these laws, to anyone. You will be excommunicated if you do. Then they give a little exception. You can explain it to a single student privately, but you can't write it down. But you can't explain it to multiple students. Now, Maimonides already is breaking a law, just like Freud broke a law, talking about sex. Really? Talk about sex? It's embarrassing. It's private. It's not your business, right? So Maimonides played with it this way. He said, he calls his book, he called The Guide for the Perplexed a ma'amar. A spoken article, a series of lectures. He says it's not a book, because the rabbi said you're not supposed to write about this. So I'm not going to write. I'm just going to write letters to only one student.
There's always a workaround, right?
There's a workaround, you know. Yeah, right. But he's so careful with his words, like analysts should be careful with their words, right? So, but he careful with his words, so he can say I'm going to talk about things that we're told not to talk about. But then he says, why do this? Well, for several reasons. One is the Torah is written for humankind. So we should, it's something having to do with our inner lives. So we should discuss everything in Torah because it's valuable. Two, the Jews are in exile. So we're going to lose our knowledge if we don't find a way to memorialize it. I didn't say write a book. I said to memorialize it. And three, I'm near the end of my life. If I die and I don't say this to one of my favorite students, it'll be lost. Those are the three reasons he wrote this guide for the perplexed.
And that's what you see, the linkage between Maimonides and Freud, the layers of meaning.
And he says, the more we understand the letters, the better lives we will have internally. That's the major link to Freud.
There's another link that you point out, and that is the role of mourning in their creativity. And I'd like to read a paragraph about that from your book. Famously, Maimonides' older brother drowned. It was the trauma of his life, and we know Freud had many losses. And you write, prior to the deaths of their beloveds, when the loss occur of Maimonides' brother David and of Freud's father Sophie and Heinle, the informed heart can reach within to explore the most hidden of secrets, to reveal the workings, the techniques of concealment of their own minds. And neither of them turned to mystical accounts to explain the mysterious. They relied on reason, informed by the heart. Maimonides would have referred to this as knowledge, wisdom, infused with awe. Freud, the ego infused by libidinal powers, at times fenced in by superego constraints. That is, part of the successful working through of mourning, to the degree feasible, included an almost ruthless self-examination, a questioning of received wisdoms, going against socially acceptable beliefs, jeopardizing their standing within their own communities in order to seek out the more valuable, hidden, the more meaningful, in order to elevate themselves out of the depths of mourning and then go beyond, reach higher, to elevate their inner knowledge and lived lives. It's a beautiful paragraph. And can you tell us more about how mourning was a shared creative spark for them?
Let me add in a personal account, too. You know, why did I write two books and publish them in a year, although one took 10 years, but still. We know, as analysts, there's a fairly long literature on mourning and its connection to creativity from the time of Freud's work to George Pollack's work and others. But that's too intellectual. Let me make it more personal. And then I'll talk about Freud and Maimonides. My father and my mother lost a combination of 10 siblings and a granddaughter, murdered by the Nazis, plus their parents, you know, by the way, and aunts and uncles, by the way. For me, I've heard stories about their siblings, and I think, look what they would have done, what they would have created, not just what families, but ideas. And I've realized, actually, in my analysis, that I've for years have been trying to make up by writing books what would have been done by the aunts and uncles that I never knew or cousins I never knew because they were murdered. So creativity can have a reparative, never enough perhaps, but a reparative quality. Why go on living, the mourner may feel at a certain moment. With Maimonides, his brother, who was a trader, international trader, younger brother said, you study, you write books, I'll support you. And for some 10 years, Maimonides was only writing his great 14-volume Mishneh Torah, Return to the Torah. He did over a 10-year period from his 20s to his 30s because his brother supported him. Now, his brother goes on a long trip. He decides he has to go to India because there might be, you know, more work there. And Maimonides says, don't go. And the other says, you know, you'll take care of my wife and children while I'm gone, but I have to do this. And he's drowned with all of his wealth and the boat are lost. So Maimonides not only loses his brother, but has to now support himself and his brother's wife and children and his own family. And he was trained as a physician, so he worked as a physician, becomes the physician for the vizier of Egypt and all his relatives too. And then in the evening, he took care of people who were too poor to pay him. And sometimes he was so exhausted, he would lie down on his couch while he saw patients. So Maimonides knows there's a rule in Jewish law that you cannot mourn someone beyond a year, because then you might worship them like they're gods. For instance, in some parts of Judaism that I'm acquainted with, you can't put down a tomb before a year of mourning, because people might start going to the tomb and treating it like a stone god. So there are rules around that, but nevertheless, Maimonides is so honest. In one of his letters, 8 years later, he writes to a rabbi, and said, "I am still mourning the loss of my brother. It's a wound that I can never recover from." That's honest. He knows the Jewish law, but he also tells us what's in his heart. So he starts the guide shortly after the death of his brother when he's working as a physician. And he knows at some level, it seems to me, I need to go something beyond the bounds of what's acceptable in Jewish culture. Freud, too, after the death of his father, listens to his own dreams in a way that no one else has ever done. At one point, Freud, in order to remember his dreams better, you may know about this, moved a wooden bench, not a bed, into his library so he would write down his dreams as soon as he woke up, you see. So he was dedicated to examining the internal, but examining parts of his internal that would be completely outrageously unacceptable in Viennese hypocritical culture, and thinking about sex and childhood and so on. So that's the link that I found intriguing. And what I'm reading, you'll hear, I read the Torah as an account of inner life and behavior both. It's also an account of the history of the Jews. It's an account of the creation of the world. It's also tells you about worshiping God. It says all that too. But the thing that interests me, and I think Maimonides, is a guide for inner life and outer life. In a way, Freud was, his idea is that if you listen to inner life, if you repair it, you will live a better outer life. I'm sorry, that's a long answer.
No, it's a fine answer. And it's a lovely segue to your clinical material where this comes to fruition. So tell us in disguise, of course, about some of the cases where you felt religious affiliations, theirs and yours, played an important part.
I will, and I'll tell you examples of where it didn't play an important part because it wasn't important to the patient. So one patient I treated 27 years with severe borderline anorexia nervosa, nearly died twice, started when she was 17. She, you know, came through treatment. Bob Wallerstein supervised her, and when I presented as a control case, when I presented her 2 years later to him again as a follow-up, he said, "You treated this girl? But she's married and has two children now, and her husband is a wonderful man. And so are you sure you treated this girl?" It was unrecognizable to him. But she did. She had two children then. She went on to have two more children, and she's led a remarkably good life.
And that's where religion was not a meaningful part of treatment.
She came from a Catholic family, and it was not an important part of her treatment, let's just say that.
All right.
It would have been a distraction.
Sure.
Now, I have a colleague who was a former student of mine and is a born-again Christian now. And I know he was one of my best residents. And he's never practiced analysis. And I know that he became born again because if he didn't, his wife would divorce him. That was the deal. And at one point, he said to me confidentially, that I was visiting, and he leaned forward out of his chair, and he said, "I still hope I can save your soul." I was shocked at that. Here is someone who said to me also that his belief in Christ goes way beyond his belief in analysis. And I thought, well, you're limiting who you can treat. That's okay, but you're limiting. But then he wrote to me recently. He sent me a message. He said, "You know, I could say more to my Jewish analyst than I could say to my closest friends." And I asked why. I was curious. You know, I know he's done that with me because I'm one of his, not just a former teacher, but a someone he cares for. And he told me, he says, "Most of my friends are Episcopalian or born-again Christians." So I said, "So why can you say more to your analyst?" He says, "Because he's Jewish, he's smart, and he's the other." That intrigued me. That's another way to look. Yeah.
Let me ask you about that. What strikes me in that story, he says, "I have more of a belief in Christ than I have a belief in psychoanalysis." I'm interested in the word belief. I understand belief when it comes to Christ and or God. I don't understand the phrase having a belief in psychoanalysis. I know people say it.
Yeah.
It is because it's a skill. It's a relationship. It's an act of creativity that for many patients works and is a powerful, beneficial piece of their life. That isn't a belief. That's an experience. Hopefully, many of us have had it. So I bristle a little bit when people use the word belief in both settings.
I agree with you, but let me put it to you how extreme a problem this is for our discipline. We're both physicians. We have colleagues who are endocrinologists, cardiologists, and surgeons. They wouldn't say, I have a belief in endocrinology. Mm-hmm. They know endocrinology. They expect to be a progressive field that improves on time. But you and I also know people who have, quote, beliefs in psychoanalysis as if it's a religion.
Right.
Or I'll give you another example of this. A colleague recently, a close friend, told me that when he was much younger, Margaret Mahler was invited to his institute. And then in an evening at Justin Call's house, some of the candidates said, you know, we're troubled by the transgressions in analysis. Freud analyzing his own daughter, Melanie Klein analyzing her two kids, one of whom suicides. Heinz Kohut analyzing himself and saying a second analysis was by someone. That's it. Lots of transgression. Hegg Holmuth was one of the first child analysts, analyzes her nephew, who comes back a few years later and shoots her to death. These are significant transgressions. So they say this to Margaret Mahler, and they say, what do you make of this? And her response was, tell me any movement, artistic or otherwise, that doesn't have its border crossings. And I said to my colleague, the problem is she thinks of analysis as a movement, like, I don't know, communism, instead of as a clinical enterprise. Or Bob Wallerstein said, a discipline, you see? So how we think about analysis is problematic. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Your cases. You have patients that...
I'll give you one that resonated with me quite strongly because we're limited on time. This is a patient I think you heard about. A patient comes to me, and I'm disguising it, and his father was his grandfather was a significant, it was in the concentration camp, survived as a child, comes to Israel, and after a couple years, when the Israelis know about his background, becomes a spy. And the Mossad, you know, you see it on TV shows, they're really that good. And becomes a quiet hero. Nobody's supposed to know in Israel that he's a spy. All the neighbors know who he is, you know. He doesn't tell anyone. He doesn't tell except his grandson. So he comes to me, and the way he had a way of recruiting people when he needed someone late at night, he would go to someone's house late at night, knock on their apartment door, and he wouldn't say, this is so-and-so, so-and-so. He would say, the Jewish people need you. That's all. Nobody said no to him. You know, the Jewish people need you. So when this man comes in to analysis, he says to me, the Jewish people need you. It was a somewhat impersonal way, but very moving way of his. And my response, he doesn't know about my father's background or my background. My response was, I'm going to take care of this man. Now, I go to take care of everyone that comes in, child, adult. But this resonated with me very personally, and I had to be careful. I had to be careful that I didn't idealize his grandfather the way he did, so that I could take care of the ailing part of the grandfather living inside him, not just the heroic part. Hmm.
And have there been clinical situations where it hasn't gone well because of religious attachments?
I'll give you one example that was sad, very sad to me. I treated a boy, a Chinese boy, and for about a year, and he was responding extremely well to clinical treatment. He loved coming. He was getting better symptomatically. The father wasn't happy about this because the father had a tyrannical control over the family. The father never worked. But he always wrote grants for this and grants for that, would send me his grants. And I looked at one, I thought, this is ridiculous. It's silly. You know, I didn't know how to say it politely to him. And the mother worked terribly hard and made a lot of money as a Silicon Valley something or other. So at one point, the mother said to me, you know, she said she really missed being home and wanted to be a stay-at-home mother and so on. But it's been 10 years and, you know, the father still hasn't found anything. And when I worry about things, the mother says, father says, Christ will provide. Don't worry, Christ will provide. And I said, perhaps not properly, I said, well, crisis certainly provided for him. He has a wife who works arduously while he sits at home and plays with his computer. I didn't say that part. But the boy came to me after 1 year and with significant improvement able to get into school. He was being thrown out of a public school. I mean, he was really in a lot of trouble and getting better. The boy came to me and he said, he came very upset one day to session. I said, what's upsetting you? He says, well, my Christian school, he went there on Sundays, teacher said, you know, your doctor may be a nice man in helping you, but he's going to burn in hell. And he said, the boy said, I'm worried about you. I don't want you to burn in hell. So I thought, well, I better talk to the parents about this because this is going to be a problem. And I spoke with both parents, and the mother was apologetic, and the father said, no, he's right. You are going to burn in hell. And I said to the father, if you sincerely believe that, and you say that to your son, he said, of course I tell my son. I said, then I can't treat your son because it creates a conflict between me and you. And I terminated the treatment because of that. I didn't want to create a conflict for the boy where he couldn't win no matter what he did.
It is a sad story. Yes.
Yeah.
Nathan, you've been very gracious in sharing your heart, your past, your passions. And I'm hoping this will be the beginning of conversations with colleagues from many traditions who will be as open as you. And I want to thank you. Thank you for your writing. That book I reviewed, it was a very favorable review. I recommend the book on Jacob and Joseph and the ego ideal. It will be listed in the recommended readings. And thanks for joining. I appreciate it.
Harvey, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.